Blog Talk Radio.
Never win first place. I don't support the team. I can't take direction, and my socks are never clean. Teachers dated me. My parents hated me. I was always in a fight.
Welcome to Fire Talk Productions. This is Fire Talk, and I'm your host, Russ Letica. Also with me today is my co-host, Mel Cole, and producer, and my brother co-host, David Little Eagle. Once again, today we have with us Dr. Nadine Vaughn. So with that, I'd like to get her online and let her explain who she is, herself, to you, and also to introduce our topic for today, which is borderline personality disorder. So with that, Nadine, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, Russ. Good to talk to you today.
Good to talk to you. I'm sorry I wasn't here last week with you. I had work and I couldn't get out of it, but I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with you again today.
Thank you. And I think it was a wonderful show last week, and hopefully this one will feel just as good, at least to those of us that are on the line, and hopefully to those who are out there listening. You wanted me to say something about myself. And
yeah.
So very, I'll try to be brief on that, but I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them. My background kind of followed two routes. On the one hand, I'm a licensed psychologist. I've been licensed in three different states, which if you've ever tried to go for licensing of anything, you know that's no easy task.
Correct.
I started out many years ago as a counselor in Florida and then moved to California, became a psychologist, and and in Washington State. Now I'm back in Florida, so I'm delighted to be here. This is my home state. I also, that second path that I followed is the performing arts. And so for many years, really since early childhood, I was involved in the performing arts, and I had my own theater company for many, many years when I was on the West Coast. And one of the things that I tried to do, and I think to a great extent I was able to do, was to combine the two things that I was doing in my life for work. And one was psychology and the other was the performing arts. And I formed something called Living Theater. Now, Living Theater is not a new name. It's something that has been done for many years, and I borrowed the name from some folks that had done it in the early part of the last century. But essentially what it meant for me was, instead of doing theater and trying to be a better actor on stage, it meant to try to reach into who we are inside, that part of us that perhaps got damaged a bit when we were growing up, or maybe just set aside for whatever good reasons, and to pull that out and to be who we are fully, not just the part of us that survived whatever we went through in our lives, but that part of us that is passionate about life, because often that's what gets left in the dust. Now, that's pertinent to today's talk, because we're talking about what's called a psychological disorder, and anybody who knows me realizes that I really resisted for many years using psychological diagnostic terms. But I will talk about it in those terms today, because people need to know if they have something that is diagnosable and that may be treatable, so they don't have to suffer with it. So in essence, to wrap it all up, I've been able to bring together my background in psychology, my background in performing arts, and most recently in the last decade have become very involved in writing, written two or three novels now, and in filmmaking. And in fact, the most recent novel, called Native Land, Lost in the Mystery of Time, is my own work in many ways. It's not autobiographical, but it does talk about experiences that I was told about by my own grandmother, some very, very hard times in her history. And hopefully we're going to be able to make that into a movie. We're in pre-production on that as we speak. So as you might notice, and I hope that you hear, I am all for really finding out who we are at our core, and then to whatever extent we can, heal that, and then live our lives so that we can feel the passion and the joy and the happiness that we may not have had as children. Okay, so that's that.
Well, I'm going to tell you, listening to what you just said, what a beautiful insight to be able to take the two paths in your life and bring that compassion together for one healing. I think that is an amazing insight to be able to do that.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I try to walk the talk. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean.
I've been doing this work for many, many more years than most of our listeners have been alive, probably. And I'll date myself by saying I started during the Vietnam War. And one reason I went into the field was because good friends of mine were going over and either not coming back or coming back very altered. And so I have spent a lifetime looking at, you know, what can we do as human beings, as individuals, to bring back that part of us that got lost or hurt or stomped on. And so I've tried to live it my own life. In fact, when I got my doctorate, I had left a marriage where I didn't know why I left. He was a good person. He, you know, he did everything I always thought a man should do, so why on earth was I leaving? And sometimes we do that, those things. And anyway, so, yes, I'll stop talking about me because I want to talk about the topic at hand.
Great. Well, I want to tell you, I was reading up on a little bit, and I, from what I'm understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong because I'm learning as you teach, is that the borderline personality disorder is like, it's like a cluster of many different things.
Mm-hmm.
But the borderline personality disorder is just one part of that cluster. Is that how it's explained better?
Well,
did I explain
yes.
that correctly?
Yes. What I'm basing this diagnosis on, and again, keeping in mind that this does not a person make. Okay, a person
okay.
can be diagnosed with something. That does not mean that they are a borderline. I really, really resist and, you know, take umbrance to somebody calling somebody a schizophrenic or a borderline or a depressed. You know,
okay.
we are people. Yes, we have there. It's a complicated diagnosis. Once you get used to seeing it and know what you're looking for in terms of the DSM-4 is TR is the whole name of it, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM, and then 4 is simply the edition of it, and the TR is something they added. This is a book that literally describes every what's called psychological disorder in it and what must be present to have it. Now, last week we talked about PTSD and how it would be easy to say, oh, somebody has PTSD because they have this, this, and this. But unless you
mm-hmm.
have all of them, you don't have it. And the same with borderline. And
I'm
even more concerned about borderline because borderline personality disorder carries with it some stigmas that some of the others don't. Maybe I should just go on and tell you what they are.
Sure.
What causes BPD or borderline personality disorder? It could be any number of things, but generally someone who ends up with borderline personality disorder has experienced during their childhood or certainly for a long period of time intrusive experiences. Now, what is an intrusive experience? It's a recurrent act of injury, like being beat up or sexually molested over a long period of time, or over a period of time that the child doesn't believe is going to end. It's a horrible thing. I mean, one of the beautiful things about online is we get to meet wonderful people and hear good things, but there are also some very painful things. And I just saw one before I came online about a little boy in another country who was just being terribly abused, kicked and hit by other people, and yet others were just standing by, and I'm thinking my heart is breaking. I don't want to see this, and yet we know that this goes on. And so these intrusive experiences, that little boy has to come up with a way to deal with the horror of what he's experiencing as a child. And my guess is this is not the only incident.
And what you just said, he's not experiencing it like in his own home, behind closed doors, behind walls. He's experiencing this in an aspect
yes.
of it's being done out in public. It's social.
Yes. And so if you can only imagine that this little boy who was just cowering on the ground with people all around just standing and somebody taking pictures, and a grown man kicks him and grabs him and drags him, and another one kicks him. I mean, this is not just one parent. This is several people. And I wanted to turn away.
Yeah.
And yet in my own life, in my own business as a psychotherapist, this is what I look at with so many people. I look at this, and I don't turn away, because if I turn away, then how will they ever heal? So to
wow.
understand that someone has these intrusive experiences and it's been recurrent and it's been an act of injury, the other thing that goes into the cause of borderline personality disorder is something called traumatic neglect. And traumatic neglect is something that, believe it or not, can happen even with the parents present in the home. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute because it's very current. But most of the time when we think of traumatic neglect, we think about people who were placed in orphanages, what used
mm-hmm.
to be called children's homes. There were studies done early on of infants in these homes where they were dying, and they didn't know why. Their diapers got changed, and they got fed a bottle. You know, why were these children dying? And they did a study decades ago and discovered something that I'm sure you already know and probably most of our listeners realize. And that was that when they took half of these children and all they did differently was they held them. That's all they did differently. They held the children, the babies. And the babies that were held, plus being given, you know, a bottle and diaper, they lived. Mm-hmm. And the ones that were not held, many of them did not live. That is an example of traumatic neglect, the absence of holding, loving, and touching as a child. Now, as I said, unfortunately, that can happen even with people in the home. And
sure.
An example of that right now, and I hate to say this because a lot of people are probably not going to want to hear this, but when a parent is online all the time,
yes,
or they're working and then they come home and then they're tired and they have
yes.
no use to, you know, be around a kid because they're tired and it's all about them, that child could be one of these children that grows up experiencing
sure.
traumatic neglect.
You know, and it could happen as innocently as a single parent
mm-hmm.
who needs to work two jobs
yes.
to support the child. So it could happen innocently, too, although it's probably a higher majority where it happens, how you're explaining it. Because I have seen in my own experience with employees that I work this job, I work that job, and I'm like, well, who takes care of your kids? You know, and I,
mm-hmm.
the first thought that comes to my mind is they're getting financial love, not emotional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
and sometimes
yeah.
a parent will even say that. Well, don't you want to have nice clothes? Wouldn't you? And the child, if they
yeah.
really listen
yeah.
to the child, what does the child say?
They just want time with the parent.
Yeah.
yeah. I just want your love. I don't need all this other stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, what kid doesn't say once in a while, well, I wish I had something like, you know, my buddy, or I wish I had
yeah.
this. But the bottom line, if they know that they have a choice between one or the other, they will take the love. And I can tell you that I was also a single parent for many, many years, and I have four children.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't always have four.
yeah.
But I started with, one and then another one not too long after. And I was a single parent for much of the time, and I had a choice to make. Because
mm-hmm.
I, like other single parents, had to work. There was no question about
sure.
it. I had to, you know,
my mother did too.
Mm-hmm. Number one, we have to be ever so careful about who we leave our children with.
Yes.
Because,
yeah.
well, I don't even think I need to go into that.
Yeah.
I think all of us realize
yeah.
how dangerous that can be.
Common sense.
Yes. But if you do, and most people do these days, have to leave their children with someone, make
mm-hmm.
unexpected visits. Okay,
mm-hmm.
go to that place and just drop in. If they don't want you just dropping in, move the child.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but the thing I was getting to with that was when I got home, I had a choice to make. I could either do things like clean the house, do the dishes, spend a lot of time making meals or whatever, or I could spend it with my child and to heck with the rest. And as much as I was possibly able, I did the latter. Even though I was brought up, I was a good Southern girl, I was brought up to be, you know, make sure everything was clean. I was obsessive about it, in fact, for a long time. I had to make that choice, and it was funny because as a single woman, occasionally I would date, and I remember this one guy saying, well, maybe I should teach you how to wash dishes. And I said, well, you know, as long as nothing is growing on them and we don't have rodents and things, I think that the dishes are going to be just fine. You know, I'd rather they be with the child. But I did laugh. I thought it was funny if he only knew.
Yep. It's true. If they only knew. If you only watched my moccasins.
So, fortunately, traumatic neglect is not the only cause and by itself will not cause borderline personality disorder. So if that's the worst thing that we're doing with the child, then they're probably not going to get this disorder unless they're also having more intrusive experiences of being beat up or sexually molested, et cetera.
But there's
now,
some people who have come from the residential schools or the industrial schools who were actually the system itself structured it to where traumatic neglect was the foundation of it.
Yes.
To be able to
yeah.
love someone or be with your brother and sister and all those different things wasn't even allowed. So what do you do when you're a child who was raised in a system that fostered this and now you're trying to build a life?
Well, I think that's a wonderful question now. I think certainly, and something to be acknowledged, is a person coming out of a place like that is at a disadvantage. You know, I think anybody that says, oh, well, you know, that was then and this is now, I mean, that's just too glib.
Right.
Now, that said, as children, and I realize you also know this, but I'm just going to say it out there for those who may not have thought about this. As children, we are 100% innocent of what happens to us. As children, we are 100% innocent of what happens to us. As adults, we are 100% responsible for making the kinds of changes to heal ourselves. Now, we
Absolutely.
Don't always know what that is. Yeah, yeah. And,
you know,
and, you
those
know,
children are our future, and if we don't protect those children today, we will be in the same bleak future that we as adults are seeing right now.
Yes.
There has to be a change. If there's going to be a change in the future, it starts with those children, and it has to start with protecting the health and welfare of each and every one of them.
Yes, and, you know, unfortunately, there are adults out there who, for one reason or another, and I think it's, I'm just going to say from ignorance. I don't mean to be insulting to anybody. But, you know, when you're brought up in an environment, in, particularly in the South, I know that it's pretty well known that in the South there was a lot of corporal abuse, a lot of physical punishment of children. I was brought up in the South. I really understand that. It wasn't unique to my family. It was, you know, everybody I knew pretty much. Except my best girlfriend. My best girlfriend's parents didn't do that, and I noticed that she minded. I noticed that she did good in school. You know, nobody needed to do things to her to make her be a good girl, and that stuck with me. And even now I hear people say, well, nobody should be telling me how to raise my child. Well, in many respects, of course, but if we cross the line and we begin to do things that are clearly going to damage them,
right.
And if we didn't care about them, their children, and others in their lives, then I think that's where we need to start learning something different.
Yeah.
And so when I, you know, if I'm in Walmart or something, that's a, you know, I think a lot of people like to use that as a joke. Well, you run into everybody in Walmart. Well, you'll run into me in Walmart, too. And if I see somebody in there that seems to be abusing their child, certainly if I'd seen the thing that I mentioned earlier that was going on, there's no way on earth I would have stood still. You know, at the very least, I would have called the police for help. Now, that's another country. I don't even know if they would have come. But certainly I would have said something. Now, yeah, it's risky.
Right.
Yeah, you stand to get yelled at the very least. You know, we have to take a stand. And I know that you, Russ, and Nell and David are doing exactly that, and you're encouraging others to do that. So, yes, many of us were brought up where the rod was not spared, and we came out seemingly okay. But number one, how do they know we came out okay? Just because we're able to, you know, talk publicly in an acceptable manner?
Right.
You know, how do others know what is going on inside a human being's heart and what they're dealing with? And and so we need to learn other ways. Now, as I said, I was fortunate. I had a very best girlfriend whose parents did it differently. So when I began to have children, I made a decision. I made a lot of choices, and it's really about choice, you know, making choice. When I began to have children, I decided I was not going to do the same kind of punishment. Now, to tell you the truth, I was young. I was still a teenager. I didn't know if that would work or not. But I knew that I wanted to do something differently because it didn't seem to work so well with me. And so I made a promise to myself and to my children that I wasn't going to use the belt, the switch, the, you know, going out and pulling something off the tree to use. I wasn't going to do any of that stuff. And by golly, they turned out okay.
You know what, that's really good to hear, because you've always heard this generation say, I'm not going to raise my children the way I was raised with my parents. But then again, you have to look at the flip side of the coin. You don't have children doing then what you see children doing now. And I have to weigh that and balance that, and you know. So there is a right way to discipline, and it doesn't have to be the belt and the switch like you just explained. But
you just said
I
the
really
magic
don't know
word.
How I feel on that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Russ, you just said the magic word. There has
mm-hmm.
to be a right way to discipline. And
yeah.
I think a lot of people think, well, if I don't do it the way that it was done to me, then I don't do anything at all. Wrong.
Right.
I think that children need structure. Children need to be disciplined to learn. They just as they need to learn how to self-soothe
yeah.
when they're hurting, they need how to self-regulate when they're getting out of control. We can all do it. We're all human beings. We have
yeah.
that capability. So it's not either or. It's not either do it this way or don't do it at all. It's let's find some other ways to discipline. And, yes, it takes more time. And time
You're
is the one
right.
thing that none of us think we have enough of.
Yeah.
So,
You're absolutely
anyway,
right.
let me go back to borderline because hopefully we can just kind of bring all this together. I want to talk about some of the symptoms of borderline. Now, last week when I talked about the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, I emphasized, as I will right now, if you have one of these, or even two or three of these, it does not mean you have borderline personality disorder. It doesn't. You have to have five or more, for starters, okay? So I'm going to tell you what they are. I have about nine that I'm going to read. So that means you have to have more than half of these in order to even be considered to have borderline personality. And you still may not, because something else may be going on.
Well, I got my paper and pen ready. You go ahead, and I'll start logging myself. I'll let you know at the end of the show if I am or not.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Now, this does not include suicidal or self-mutilating behaviors. Okay, so set those aside. Frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Now, an example of this you might see is... let's say a woman gets married or a man gets married and they say, after, you know, less than a year or something, this is not working out. Well, why not? Well, because I just know it's a matter of time before they're going to leave me. Bam, that's it. That's what that means. Real or imagined abandonment, real frantic efforts. And so a person might actually leave an otherwise solid relationship because they're so fearful that they're going to be abandoned, and that is the worst thing that could happen in their minds. Number two, a pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships that are characterized by, you know, alternating between extremes of idealizing and devaluing. Okay, what does that look like in reality? Let's say that you come upon somebody and they just think you're the best thing since banana splits. I mean, they can't say enough positive about you. They love you. All of a sudden, they don't really know you, but they love you already. And they're just so there for you. And, you know, you may even wonder, you know, is this real? Well, this is one of the sides of a borderline, a person with borderline personality disorder, is because if they believe, if that person believes that you have slighted them, even if they didn't really intend, or even if you didn't really intend to do that, but you accidentally said something that triggered them, then
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden you're the worst demon in the world.
Yeah, it's like if you would have, it's like if you're thinking, they're so nice to me, what are they after?
Yeah.
What do
they
want?
Yeah. Yeah. And yet it's not even what they're after, because in that person's mind, in the mind of a borderline person with borderline personality disorder, they absolutely believe it. In that moment or in those days, those initial days or whatever, they really believe that you are the best thing in the world. They really believe they love you. They really believe they can't live without you or whatever they have told themselves and you. And it's very hard not to take the bait. It doesn't mean they're after anything else. And if you test them on that, you're going to come up clean. But the instability is what breaks it open, because let's say that, that Russ, you come across somebody and they like your radio show, and all of a sudden they can't do enough for you. They may even send you a gift or not, but they just think you're the best thing since peanut butter, whatever. And you examine, what are they after? They're not after anything. They just really think you're that terrific. What person doesn't want to believe that, because in fact you are that terrific. I mean, we are all uniquely terrific people. But when somebody is just kind of overdoes it, and then you say something like, they want to know if you can get together, and you've actually done that, but then the next time they ask, you say, I'm sorry, but I really need to work on my car.
Right.
Now, depending on what the person's trigger is, you may find yourself demonized, like you can't believe. They may go online, they may say things about you, they may call you and say, why aren't you? What's wrong with you?
That's why I make a very clear stance to make sure that I'm not put on a pedestal, or I don't put people on pedestals. It's about, with me, it's equality applied equally, and, and as I'm complimented, I compliment back type of thing. I don't like the pedestal thing, and, although I do like to hear, I'm humbled by the compliments, I don't need to hear them all the time.
And yet,
I guess I don't have it.
No, I don't think you do either. And this is the thing, Russ, that it's not up to you what they do regarding that putting you on a pedestal bit. So, and that's the disturbing part about it. If somebody does that to me, for instance, and I have had that done many times over the years. They're just coming on with all kinds of wonderful. And I try to keep my equilibrium, realizing that I don't know this person well enough yet to know if this is real or, if maybe this is a sign of something else. And then when I do disappoint them, and you will inevitably disappoint, if you are in friendship with a borderline personality, a person with borderline personality disorder, you will disappoint them. You will make them feel as if they're betrayed. There's no question about it. And when that happens, can you still keep your equilibrium? Because the only way to have a friendship with a person with borderline personality disorder is to realize that that is going on and they're still a worthwhile person. And a lot of people just don't want to do, they don't want to play because it's just too hard. It is hard.
I have definitely been in these friendships.
Yeah.
Okay, now that's just number one and number two.
Okay.
Now, as you realize, most people that you know don't do that. You do know people who have done that, but most people don't. Number three.
Right.
They have an identity disturbance. What does that mean? Well, it's a marked, persistent, unstable self-image or sense of self. Now, a lot of people can have that. We all grow up. We all survive childhood. And we all have things happen to us, some awful and some less than awful. But an identity disturbance is much more marked, much more persistent. So this person, it's not just they're trying to heal from this thing that happened, but if it's not this, it's this other one. And if it's not this other one, it's this other one. It's never stable. Identity disturbance. It's a disturbance. It's like you never know what you're going to get when you see this person. Number four, impulsivity. That means they act without thinking in at least two areas that are potentially self-damaging. Okay. Now, again, this is one that sounds like some other disorders that I'm not going to talk about right now, but know that this one is just one of the five that have to be present for borderline. So what would be an example of impulsivity in at least two areas that are potentially self-damaging? Addiction.
So quitting your job, erratic work history would probably be an indicator.
If you think addictions, you'll cover most of them. So whether it's overspending, having to have sex all the time and really getting into problems because of it. Sometimes in relationships, somebody will be in a relationship with somebody and they have a good sexual relationship, and yet the other person steps out anyway. That's on them. Now, it doesn't mean you need to stay with them, but it probably is an example of something that is not right. So in their own experience. So spending, sex, substance abuse, reckless driving, binge eating, those are all examples of impulsivity that are potentially self-damaging. And again, we're not including suicidal or self-mutilating behavior in this. That's something else. Number five. This we are talking about, recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures or threats or self-mutilating. Now, the one that mutilating, now the one that I said it's not that and it's not that, well, this one is. This is it. Recurrent suicidal behavior. What does that mean? Let's say that you're in a relationship with somebody and you realize that it's not working. They probably realize it's not working too, and so you decide you're going to break up, and then all of a sudden they're suicidal. They say, well, I can't live without you. I'm going to kill myself. And what does the other person usually do?
Usually comes back for guilt, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, who wants to have that on their hands? I mean, nobody.
Right.
I don't know of any human being that wants to think that they were potentially the cause of somebody else's suicide. Well, the truth is, you're not. If somebody threatens suicide, yeah, they may eventually do it. But if they threaten suicide because you need to not be in that relationship with them and you're trying to make a healthy choice in your life and they're saying, but I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to cut myself or whatever, it's not about you. It's about that person and what they need. They need treatment.
Right.
Right.
You know, they need it big time. And so if you want to do anything at all, don't get back with them. Take them in to see a therapist, and then it's up to them.
Because at that point, they would follow you, because in their delusion, they would think that doing this for the other person would be a way to keep them.
Uh-huh.
So you're right. That would be the role of that other person, to only comfort them in the realms of bringing them in to take care of a problem that someone would say, I will kill myself if you leave me.
Exactly. Exactly. Because there are a lot of people out there who are unstable, and when somebody does threaten suicide, even if they do it repeatedly, our statistics show that, yeah, they eventually probably will do it unless they get some help.
They will succeed, correct.
Yeah, and sometimes it's accidental. You know,
right, it's not that they really meant to. It's like they wanted to bring it close enough to get that reaction that they're looking for, and you're right, it turns into a very bad
really
accident.
Yeah. So it never, I would never, ever, ever make fun of a person who is threatening suicide, ever, ever, because that could be the one thing to push them right over the edge.
Sure.
That doesn't mean that I have to pull them back into my life as a partner.
Right.
But what it means to me, though, to the extent that I'm able, is that I will try to get them help. If they don't want it, then I will not allow that to make them part of my life again. That may sound cold, but the alternative is to live a life where you are absolutely, I mean, you know, the person who's trying to do the right thing could get so unhappy in their own life that they may actually end up ending their life.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't sound as cold to me as...
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sal.
I've been in a relationship where a person has threatened suicide and as a means to keep me there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the first three or four times it carried weight, but then it became a tool.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard sometimes to know whether it's just a tool somebody's using to keep you there or in reality would they really do something like that. But you're saying no matter what, it's a serious sign
that it's both true. Again, it's kind of like, you know, the part about the I love you, I hate you, and they really believe they love you, and they really believe they hate you. Well, when a person has borderline personality disorder and they really believe that they're going to kill themselves, they really believe it.
Right.
You know, so in one sense, they're probably not just using it as a tool. They may be hoping against hope that it'll keep you there if they feel that desperate.
Right.
But but there is also a very real part of themselves that doesn't want to live. So you don't ever want to just brush it off. But on the other hand, you really need to this is one thing I want to say about suicide. I mean, there's a lot to be said about it. But one of the things to know about suicide is that when somebody is suicidal, they are also homicidal. And that's why they need professional help.
Right.
If, you know, if I'm a professional person, I've been doing this for many, many years in my life, and yet if there was somebody very close to me in my own family, I would get them professional help from someone else. Because they need to have somebody who's objective and who can use all the skills at their disposal to help. So you hear about these situations where, and it's, I don't know why it's often with men, but more recently it's become women too, where they'll kill themselves and they'll take their children with them.
Right.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
was probably a case of suicide. That when it got right down to it, they thought, what do I have to lose?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, you know, that does take a lot of common sense there, and it's the opposite of the ignorance you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
When I've never heard that phrase like that, when someone is suicidal, they're also homicidal. Because mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you, when I'm thinking of ending my life,
mm-hmm.
the last thing on my mind would be not to take yours if you piss me off. So
yeah.
you're absolutely right. I've never heard that said like that before.
Mm-hmm.
And if I live in this world, I'm taking your ass with me. So I'm hearing you, you know.
Uh-huh. And that's why we should never take it lightly. We should never, you know, laugh at someone when they're saying that, because laughing at a person when they're suicidal, besides the damage you're doing to that human being, is also setting yourself up to be a potential victim.
Yeah. I've seen some people where their logic is to, like, well, go ahead and do it then.
Yeah.
And that never made any sense to me. As like
no, that's a huge
right.
mistake.
Yes,
huge mistake. Now I can understand somebody saying it because they just get tired of hearing it.
Of hearing it, right?
But the reason that they're getting tired of hearing it is because they are continuing to try to maintain a relationship with the person.
Yes,
right.
So they're really actually enabling that person to continue
exactly.
this type of behavior.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So let me go on to the next one. So we've got the recurrent, number five, the recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures or threats or self-mutilating behavior. That's one of the nine that must be true. Number six is affective. That means emotional instability due to a marked reactivity of mood. Now, I'm reading you the words that are listed in the DSM. So some of these words, I'll just explain them, and, you know, hopefully if you guys catch that I'm not explaining something well enough, then you'll do it or ask me to say it again. But
okay.
affective instability is when somebody is emotionally up and down all over the place. Again, this is also true of a lot of other disorders. But in this case, the affective instability, the emotional up and down, is due to a marked reactivity of mood. In other words, they're reacting to something, and they're all over the place. And it may not be a huge thing, but they're all over the place. And
right.
so, for example, intense episodic dysphoria. Now, what in the heck does that mean? We know what intense means, and episodic means that it happens on episodes. In other words, it's not every day, but once in a while this happens. The dysphoria is very depressed, and it may look like major depression, you know, where they can't move, their musculature is just dragging. I mean, you can see it in their face when somebody is very, very depressed. So when we're talking about this kind of affective instability with borderline personality disorder, this person may have that periodically, this intense episode of boom. They just can't function. That's one. Or irritability. You know, all of a sudden they just, you know, a lot of people like to blame women's irritability on PMS.
Yeah.
But of course that is true, but not as many women have PMS as most people think. Some women are actually experiencing something more serious for which they might be able to get some help. And so there's the dysphoria, which is the depression. There's irritability, anxiety. And these things may not last more than a few hours. They may not last, if they go on that long, even a few days. And the person with them may think, well, I didn't do anything different. You know, why is my
right.
partner acting this
yeah.
way toward me? I didn't do it. I didn't do anything different. And that's part of, again, that this is number six. This is one of the aspects of borderline personality disorder.
Now, that could be brought on by social pressures, by work pressures, by relationship pressures. I mean, there's a, 'cause I'm going to tell you everything you just said. This has happened to me in one time or another in my life, and I believe it probably happened to 95% of human beings.
Well, probably everybody.
Life or another.
I was going to, but
I was given that little leeway there. But
you're gonna play just
hear,
a little bit safer.
I'm right into that one. I mean, I know a lot of people that's gone that and does that and goes through those episodes. I myself have been through those episodes. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's
and
it's amazing
that
when things come together and they start to make sense.
Yeah,
right, it just means that you. I'm sorry.
What it means is that this is one of the things that if you put it together with all of the others,
right,
it could mean it.
Right.
But
yeah.
In and of itself, no. That's a human thing that, you know, people do.
Yeah.
If I did that and I also had the recurrent suicidal behavior and I also was, you know, addicted to different substances and I couldn't stop doing it and I also, you know, if you do all these things or five out of these nine, then you've got a diagnosis. But if you find yourself doing one of these or maybe even two or three, as I said at the beginning, does not mean you have borderline personality disorder.
You know what?
I think
you just brought up a very good point. No?
I think that the way one of the signs is if the whole house is doing a mood check on you when you get up in the morning, then there's an issue. Because usually with a personality like this, the entire house and the dynamics of it are driven by that one person's mood when they get up in the morning.
Yeah.
That's kind of sad,
isn't it?
Yeah, and believe me, I've lived with this. But I don't know the difference between that and, like, bipolar and how the rapid cycling and the different things that happen with that. So it kind of blends into this to where...
Well, it is different. And, you know, if we do a talk on bipolar, I can tell you some more specifics, but I'll just tell you a little bit right now. In bipolar 1, which is the most serious one and the one that most people think of when they think of bipolar, what did it used to be called?
Manic depressive.
Right.
Yeah.
And so in bipolar 1, the extreme of the mania is way up there. It's not just that they gamble. It's not just that they have a problem with drugs, but they do it in such a way that it could, you know, they gamble their whole mortgage payment or their kids' college money or whatever. I mean, it's very severe. That's in the mania aspect of it. And the depressive part, of course, is, you know, when I talked about the affective instability, the difference is that with somebody with manic depressive or bipolar disorder, it's more of a cycle. It's more, in some ways, it's more predictable. Whereas with borderline personality disorder, it's not. You know, it might not happen for months or years, and then for some reason, for a few hours or a few days, it'll come up. Now, it's not true that it won't happen for a few months or years, but it's not predictable. It's not cyclic in the same way that bipolar is. So, again, you know, one of the reasons that there are people that are trained in these things is to the extent that we want to label people, and I guess we want to, so if there's a possibility that we can treat people and help them, you know, then it's real important to have it done by somebody who knows what they're doing. Because if we're doing it for each other or even family, it just doesn't work.
That makes sense. It really does. Well, it did to me. Nell, did it make sense to you?
Yes, complete.
I want to get David in the conversation, too. I'm going to ask this
question.
Hey,
David, where are you at?
I'm here just enjoying the freeway. It's very, very, very educational, and it can be very confusing, which is why I agree with you totally, Nadine, that either self-diagnosis or diagnosis from anybody close to you can be, if not dangerous, could be downright fatal. So
that's exactly right.
I think, you know, this is just, I think that this is an important topic because according to one theory that I heard, and it was interesting, and it's based on a book called I Hate You, Please Don't Leave.
Yeah.
Please Don't Leave. Which, you know, I had my pros and cons about the book because, you know, it's dated at this point. It was written in the 80s, and now we're in the year 2011. But he did bring up an interesting point of how societal mores can affect the borderline personality. Freud, of whom I am not a fan, nor am I an air conditioner of his. I'm not into Freudian psychology, but he dealt with a good thing, by the way, David. Well, he spoke of the neurotic female, and most of them had such terrible issues with their daddies. Mostly with their daddies, and as I look at the societal development that we see, for example, here in the United States, I could see an increase in borderline personality disorders because I think that the line of what is right and what is wrong is being so dimmed by political powers, by governmental decisions, by corporate intrusions, that people really don't know what is right or what is wrong. So I think that Freud may have had a point, and I'd like to know your perspective on the societal role in borderline personality disorder.
Okay. Well, I think you opened up a whole big area that we could probably spend a few shows on. So I'll try to bring it back down to something that we might be able to focus on right now. And it's good stuff, David. I mean, you know, this is real important. I agree with you absolutely that our society has changed in such a way that it's hard for a lot of people to know what's right and what's wrong. I mean, even in our earlier conversation about how do you discipline your child, in my childhood, what was considered right and lawful is now considered wrong and unlawful. A person who's been brought up during those years may rightly feel confused. Well, if it was once right, why is it not right now? And if it's not right now, then does that mean that I committed a crime back then? I don't think so. So, you know, those kinds of things come up. So absolutely, our society has changed so much. And the fact that, just think about for a moment, pornographic material has exploded. It blows my mind to know. I mean, it used to be that people who enjoyed pornography had to, you know, mail off for it and it came back in a plain wrapper, you know, or they'd sneak into, you know, some kind of a girly place or something. But now, people can just go online and it's everywhere. In fact, it's really hard to avoid. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, delete sometimes if they happen to think you're interested. I have taught human sexuality for many, many years. I haven't taught it for a few years now, but I began teaching it in the 1970s, and I taught it all the way up into the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And so as I would do research to know what best to present to my classes, and it was all in college, you put sex in online, and guess what you get? You get a whole bunch of garbage. So,
yeah.
So things that used to be not okay at all are now, you know, children are exposed to this stuff. And some parents say, well, what can I do about it? Well, that's a whole other subject, and I would really do something about it. But we do have our society is you know, making excuses for bad behavior of people and welcoming them back into their community's embrace when they've done things that, you know, 20, even 10 or 20 years ago would not have been acceptable. Now, that said, I'm going to mention one thing about Freud, because there are probably a lot of people out there listening who associate Freud with psychology. What I want to say about Freud, I'll try to be nice.
Okay, I'll try.
Freud was a person who, the good thing that he did was he brought people's attention to what goes on inside a human being beyond our blood and bones. You know, that there is something else going on, a mind, emotions, and so forth. So he was one of the people, not the only one, but he was one of the people early on in last century that brought that to people's attention, that, yeah, there's more to us than that. That's the good stuff. Just about everything else he ever said, in my opinion, is not good. And the reason is because, and this is not a negative really about him so much as it's a statement about the era in which he practiced. He was in Austria, and he was a medical doctor. We didn't have psychiatrists yet. And he saw a lot of women patients who lived in very, very wealthy, elite lives, where they went horseback riding every day and so forth and so on. To Freud's credit, he absolutely refused to believe that a man would incest his own daughter. He would not believe it. And therefore, when these women came in to see him, and his word was neurotic, these neurotic women would come in to see him, and they'd say that my father did this or my father did that. He wouldn't believe it. He believed that these women were imagining things, and therefore they were neurotic, and therefore he came up with a couple of theories, which he called the Electra Complex, and what was the other one? There's one
The Oedipal.
Oedipal and Electra. That's where a boy falls in love and wants to make love with his mother, and a girl falls in love and wants to make love with her father. Well, that's where I draw the line. I don't believe it, not for a second. And I think that he did a lot of damage with those theories.
Must have been Catholic.
I had to say it.
Well, as a matter of fact, I doubt that he really was anything religious at that point. But he was doing his best to try to come up with some theories to bring people's attention to there's more. But unfortunately, the way he did it did incredible damage to women over the years and allowed an awful lot of people, men and women, to believe that there really is something called the Oedipal complex and the Electra complex, and that women really do dream about riding horses because they want to make love. All that's garbage. And
holy
I think
cow.
That, huh?
Holy
God,
cow.
An exclamation.
No, horses, not cows.
And so, you know, I think anybody who's really studied psychology and the history of it and how this all came about understands that. Now, that's not to say that some good hasn't come from people who then went on to come up with other theories. There's someone named Carl Jung, J-U-N-G, who was, you know, studied under his work, and I think was a terrific guy and came up with some really wonderful theories, one of which is that we're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to believe that. Can you prove it? Probably not.
You know, and then there's a whole society, a whole generation of people who raised their children according to Dr. Spock. Dr. Spock's own child committed suicide.
Yeah.
You know,
go ahead.
No, it's just, you know, I just wanted to bring that, you know, it's the similarities of almost what you just talked about, Freud, with his ridiculous theories. When women would come and say that these things were happening to them in their childhood. But Dr. Spock was the same way. He had a nation hypnotized on how to raise your children correctly.
Well, there was a movement. It was called the behaviorist psychology. And there were people in that movement, which was kind of the American version of the European Freud, except it was a very, very different version of psychology, where they thought that they used the word tabula rasa, that when a child was born, that there was nothing there was no soul, no spirit, no nothing, and that everything that the child became was a reaction to something, some behavior of their own or of someone else. And there were people back then in the field that tried to raise their children in that way, and they were terrible, I'm sure terrible experiences for the children, but also terrible failures because it's not true.
Right.
And
it makes sense to me.
I'm sorry?
That doesn't even make sense to me. You know, there's shining stars in every dark spot of this world.
Yes.
You know,
now,
people come over tremendous childhoods and become something in their lives and help people.
Absolutely.
So I don't believe that. You know,
neither do I. And
I
you can't account for, you know, if you were to argue the point and say, well, how can you say that somebody like Viktor Frankl, who went through the worst of the worst in the Nazi concentration camps over in Europe, and yet he came out of it to go on to teach people about how to find meaning and love and so forth. And, of course, our whole Native tradition over here in this United States, there are people who have been brought up in families in generations of people who have felt victimized by those who came after and yet have continued on and are still strong and are still fighting and are still loving. You know, none of that can be accounted for by that kind of early behavioristic look on things, nor by Freud. So you might wonder, well, what kind of psychologist are you? What did you study? Would you like to know?
Yes, sure. What did you study? Sure.
It has a name. It's actually called, and I'll say it once, but it's not important, existential humanistic.
Existential.
Existential humanistic psychology.
Yes.
And what that
means. What does that involve?
What does it mean is existential means that when I look at a person, I look at them as existing within a larger context of family, beliefs, culture, etc. All those matter. That's the existential part. The humanistic part is, I believe, that in their hearts, that people, particularly children before they get messed up by somebody else, really want to do the good and healthy thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you put those two things together, and you have something that's very, very similar to Native tradition.
Yes, children in a healthy lifestyle want to please people.
Mm-hmm.
They're pleasers. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be loved.
Now,
they want to be accepted.
I'm sorry, Rob. The question that I have about that is that, like a coin has two sides, existential or humanism. I agree with my brother. You know, if a child is raised in a positive and let's say spirit building manner, then it becomes a second nature to that child to grow up into a person who wants to do what's good and to do what's right. Maybe not necessarily to excel in that thing, but to do the best he or she can to be a productive, I hate that word for reasons that maybe we could get into in another show, but a contributing member of society, which would be kind to people, be kind to animals, be kind to the environment. But then you have, on the other side, the child who grows up in a negative environment, and what I've observed, and I'm not a professional. If anything, I am under a lay person in the area of psychology or psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, but in my observations of society, I've also seen people who grew up in very negative and very painful environment who also go out of their way to please, but it's more out of fear of rejection. So two sides to even existential humanism, if you think about it.
Well, I
make
agree
a very good point.
Yeah, I agree with you that sometimes people's behavior looks identical, but if you peel back the layers of the onion and see what is motivating them, you'll see some very, very different motivators.
Yeah, right.
And so right. Whereas the child that I mentioned earlier that was being terribly abused right there in public, I mean, you could see the child just looking and trying to figure out what do these people want and holding his hands up like, do with me. I mean, you know, let me know what I need to do. And so this child will try to please people and do everything he can so that he won't get abused and hurt and killed. Somebody,
yeah,
another, child, mm-hmm, another child may look like he or she is doing the same thing, but it's coming from a place of absolute trust and love because they
right.
have been trusted and loved.
Well, you know, it's a very good point that you're making because, again, in observation, the person who has a good, positive inlook and outlook,
mm-hmm.
if he or she fails the first time and say, okay, something didn't work, let me try something else.
Mm-hmm.
The person who has experienced great negativity and pain and sorrow and punishment for real or imagined offenses, the first time he or she fails, will fall into what I guess that dysphoria, that,
mm-hmm.
that state of such depression that
mm-hmm.
it takes him or her a long, long time to get
to
up.
To do it again.
And get up at all.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And some people who don't go into the dysphoric reaction may go into a rage reaction.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know,
like,
what,
why didn't you do this thing that I wanted you to do, instead of taking it inwardly as a person who has a tendency to get depressed might do, they act out. And the thing with borderline personality disorder, to get back to the topic, is that sometimes the same person may do one thing, and the next time they do something almost opposite, and you don't know which is coming at you.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a mark
right.
of the borderline.
Right.
Now,
so
there's
if
two,
you're
three
living
more.
With someone,
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, if you're living with someone with this, what is the strategy to survive it?
Well, I want to talk about that in a minute. Let me finish these last three, and then I'm going to go
okay.
over to that because I think
okay.
that's a good question. The last three, and I won't take as much time on these because they're actually a little easier anyway. Okay, so one was the frantic efforts to avoid real or imagined abandonment. Two, a pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships, alternating between extremes of idealizing or devaluing. Three, identity disturbance, persistent, marked. Number four, impulsivity in at least two areas that are potentially self-damaging. Five, recurrent suicidal behavior, gestures or threats, or self-mutilating behavior. Six, affective instability due to a marked reactivity of mood, which we've all talked about. Number seven, chronic feelings of emptiness. There was a song many years ago, and every time I heard that song, and to this day, I think, gosh, I wish somebody had reached out to that woman. Is that all there is? Remember that old song? If you haven't heard it, you should listen to it sometime because that is an example of a chronic feeling of emptiness. Number eight, inappropriate, intense anger or difficulty controlling anger with frequent displays of temper, constant anger, recurrent physical fights. You know, a person who always has road rage, but not just road rage, but they will rage at you for anything. Inappropriate, intense anger is number eight. Number nine, transient, comes and goes, stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. Let me take a moment and tell you what that means. The paranoid ideation simply means that in the absence of drugs that could make a person paranoid, so they're not on drugs, and they're not schizophrenic, which you can have a person who's paranoid schizophrenia, this person is paranoid. They believe that somebody's trying to hurt them even when they're not. And you could be reaching out to the person, you could love the person, and the person, you know, for some reason, they just want to believe that you don't really mean it. So that would be, but it's not always. It's transient, and it's usually more related to when they're feeling stressed out. With a person with borderline personality disorder, the more stressed out they feel, the more paranoid they may become. Or severe dissociative symptoms. Now, dissociation is what we talked about last week with post-traumatic stress disorder. It's very frequently what happens with a person who has experienced extreme trauma, whether as a child or in war as a result of sexual assault, where they check out. Their body's there, they're not there. And that's dissociative symptoms. And a person who's been through that kind of traumatic stress may flip into that again. And they may dissociate. It's like they're there one minute, they're not there the next. Even though physically they're still sitting there, it's like, where'd you go? And they're in that traumatic state. So of these nine things, at least five of them, and they're all pretty serious, at least five of them must be present for a person to get the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. Now I'm going to move right on to what are some treatment options? Because what's the use of talking about all this stuff? And somebody might say, "Oh yeah, well I know people like that," or maybe even I think I may have that.
I'm glad you brought that up too, and I'm glad you're going to go there, Nadine, because from listening to the last shows and listening to you on this one, I do see, and I know Nell sees, and I know Dave sees, there's a lot of similarities between these disorders. So
absolutely,
it is very important to get the right diagnosis, and I'd like you to go into that with what you're going into now.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind, and I'm underlining what you're saying about it's so important to get a diagnosis from an appropriate person. Do not get it offline. Do not even get it from what I'm saying right now. If you think you have it or somebody else has it, go see someone who's trained to do it, who can get to know you, you know, whoever you are listening out there. Because, for instance, there are these four big areas that are true for people with borderline personality disorder, and you will recognize some of them because we've already talked about them. Schizotypal, it's kind of the edge of psychosis where a person may present with a very profound depression or weird kind of idiosyncratic behaviors, just, you know, the bizarre would be the word that would come to mind, not just unusual, but bizarre. If they get an antidepressant and this person has schizotypal experience, they could go all the way over and become psychotic because it increases their REM, their rapid eye movement, their REM sleep, and so forth. So schizotypal is one of the categories that falls within borderline, and you don't want to be getting the wrong medication for that. Affective instability, we talked about. So, and I'm not prescribing by any means. You know, I want to reiterate, you know, person must see their own doctor. But, for instance, a mood stabilizer like Depakote may help a person with affective instability. And, you know, according to some professionals, it's safer and easier than lithium. Rejection sensitivity, which is very characteristic of a person with borderline personality disorder. They will smell rejection a mile away, whether it's there or not. And they tend to respond well to what's called SSRIs. And then the fourth one is angry impulsive. Sometimes a person who's very angry and impulsive all the time actually has something called a vitamin P, P as in Paul, deficiency. And this poor person probably should avoid benzodiazepines. Now, a psychiatrist is really the only person, and I'm not a psychiatrist, okay, a psychiatrist is really the only person who should make that kind of determination. So if you think you may have these, then that's who you need to see. And you need to schedule a long session, not just 7 minutes, with them. Whereas with PTSD, it's more recommended that you have high doses of SSRIs. Okay, now, that's just the medical. And fortunately, there are some medicines these days that can help a person with some of these disorders. But on a non-medical level, and this is what you and I can do, this is what we can do as friends and family members, provide a stable and predictable overall framework, and especially if they're doing therapy, and discuss any necessary deviations from that. So if you agree that you're going to see a person who has borderline personality disorder, if you agree that you're going to see them on Tuesday at 4 o'clock, then you know, do it. Don't change it on them. This is very hard for a person if you do that, this kind of person. And be prepared to tolerate and explore their negative transference issues if you do. Now, I will do group therapy once in a while, and I do evaluations of people. I try to never change my appointments unless I absolutely have to, because for some people, it is so destructive that they can't even come the next time. Number two, help this person establish a clearer sense of identity. You have to realize that they have an extremely poorly organized view of their relationship, particularly if you're a therapist or a caregiver. And that the odd and dysfunctional expectancies will come into this. So, you know, if I'm dealing with somebody who has borderline personality disorder, they may think that they can call me 24/7. Well, that's not okay. You know, I have a life. I'm a human being, and I'm not available 24/7 for however many hundreds of clients I've seen over the years or thousands. But they may have a real distorted sense of how much you're there for them. So one of the last things I would ever say to a person with borderline is, I'll always be there for you. There's no way anybody can always be there for another. For one thing, you get sick. And a person with borderline, if you get sick and you said you were going to be there for them and you can't be there because you're throwing up, that is no excuse. Number three, because people with borderline personality disorder are intense and emotionally up and down, labile is the word, and they're stressful to caregivers or significant others. This is a paradox. This sounds like the opposite. But what they need is to understand that they can avoid facing these negative interactions. Paradoxically, I'm going to read the sentence as I wrote it. Paradoxically, they need to understand that they avoid facing negative emotions, and they find it hard to grieve the relationship losses that they generate. I don't know if that made any sense. I don't think I said it quite right yet, but basically they are paradoxical, they're emotional, they're up and down, and yet they don't get that is causing the problems in their life, and that they can work on not doing that so much in order to feel better.
So let me ask you a question. With what you just said, is it possible for someone who does have this disorder or another disorder, like we spoke on the last shows, to read through these, would they be able to understand that I have this, I do that? And would they be able to not self-diagnose themselves, but would they be able to say, you know what, out of this list of 9, 8 of them involve in my life. I maybe need to go talk to someone. Do they have that type of understanding of this?
Well, actually, I said no, but I've known some people with borderline that were extremely intelligent people and kind of had a hint that they were, but there's a denial going on. It's like, especially if they're very bright, you know, I don't want to admit that I have this. It must be something else.
Nothing wrong with me. I'm normal.
Yeah. And so, you know, at some level, the person may realize, oh, it's probably true. And if they get some help, and if, you know, therapeutically or pharmaceutically, they get some help, they may realize, it is helping. Okay. That would probably be the proof in the pudding for them. Because simply saying to somebody that I think this is happening with you, because of the nature of borderline personality, they're going to feel that slight, and they're going to feel like they're going to feel paranoid that you don't love them, and they're not going to get it. You know, they're going to think that you have some ulterior motive for being mean to them.
Yeah.
Very likely. Now, that's a generalization, and there are exceptions to that. There are three more
things.
So then how
do people get to help, Nadine? How do we get people to help? If we have people walking away from relationships and just not taking the phone calls anymore, not putting into the nonsense, how do we get people to get this help if they're not seeing it themselves?
If they are at a point in their life where they realize that there's something going on here that they're not happy about. And
so they have to hit a rock bottom.
Yeah, and they don't want to believe that they're bringing a lot of this on. They will, because, in fact, they did have a rough childhood. I mean, you know, that's how it gets developed.
Yeah.
Then they may seek help. They may seek help in another form. They may come in to see a therapist because they think they have depression or one of those things, of those nine things. You know, they may come in for different reasons.
And that's what I did.
Yeah.
I had that depression, and I went and talked to my doctor, and I said, I don't know where it came from or how it came or why it came, but right now there's nothing good in my life, and I see nothing but darkness. And this was about 2 years ago, and I stayed on antidepressants for about a year and a half, and I felt good on them.
Yes.
But then I started thinking, I need to get off these. I need to help myself, and these pills, I cannot be addicted to these pills the rest of my life to assure happiness with me. You know, so I don't believe I have this, but, I mean, that's why I asked the question, do people actually see this? Because I did hit parts of my life where depression came in, especially dealing with coming off alcohol, you know,
yes.
and things like that, things that people do naturally to suppress these things. You know, so trying to clean up my life and get to where I am today, I did go through that depression, and I did notice it, but I don't believe it to be a disorder. I believe that I hit something that I didn't want to face because I didn't have to when I had the alcohol or the drug,
yes.
which now I don't have, and now I do have to face it if I choose to live a productive, good, peaceful life.
Yes. I hear you, and I agree. And I think that I'm not sitting in front of you, and so it would be a mistake for me to even think about diagnosing you, but my sense is that we're not talking about you.
Yeah.
That's not to say that
so
you don't have...
My concern would be what if I mean, I was able to see this, and I feel blessed because I was able to see it, but there's so many people who don't see it and don't get this help, and these are people who are still producing children, raising children, are still in society. I mean, how do we end it?
Well, one of the things you can do, if you know of somebody that you suspect has borderline personality disorder, you have to be more subtle with them.
Mm-hmm.
They do not respond well to heavy-duty confrontations. You will lose them, or they'll just come back on you. You have to be more subtle than people with other kind of personality disorders, you know, especially when they're saying something like, I'm afraid I'll be alone forever. No one who really gets to know me will want to stay with me or love me, or if I ignore my own needs. You know, when they start saying things like that, just be more subtle and loving with them. And understand that people with borderline personality disorder consistently generate crises. You know, I can be going through all kinds of stuff, and I'm not in crisis about it, and I can see somebody with borderline personality disorder go through exactly the same thing or much less, and every single one is a crisis.
It's a crisis, yeah. Gotcha.
And so, you know, you need to understand that they consistently generate crisis so that clear guidelines for responding can be formulated early on so that you're, you know, and when you talk to a person with this, you know, again, in a gentle way, help them understand that they're prone to dichotomous thinking. What does that mean? It's black and white, it's extremes, everything is this or that. And again, now, I don't want anybody that has just one of these to think, oh my gosh, I have it. You know, you have to have five out of the nine.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's basically bottom line is we all have stuff we're dealing with.
Yeah,
and the
everyone.
People that are most likely to commit suicide are not the little boy who was getting abused so horribly or the person who is in a flood or a tsunami, you know, tsunami or an earthquake. You know, they're trying to survive. They're trying to stay alive. The person most likely to become suicidal is the one that does have hope, but they don't feel it. And so our reaching out to people is really not in judging or in saying, well, you should be doing better than this, but to say, yeah, whatever you're dealing with, if it's hard for you, it is hard. That's it, you know. It's not. We're not comparing because we don't do as well, you know, The thing you said about the pills, and I'll kind of end with this unless you have another question, but our brain chemistry does change. And I'm not a pill person as a rule, but I have grown to respect that we have some good remedies. I think it's way overdone and more than we most people need, but there are some very good pharmaceutical remedies for some of these disorders, and this is one where it may help, because if we have been living with depression or loss for so many years, the neurons in our brain have actually learned how to fire differently. And we may need that medication to get it back in order so that we can have a semblance of a good life.
Yeah.
And sometimes it means we may need to take it for a long time.
Sure.
So anyway, yeah. I just want to, you know, say that I appreciate so much that you care so much about other people out there, that you are exploring these very difficult topics.
Well, I would like to extend that thank you to Nell Cole, our producer, who continues to bring us these shows and bring these subjects to light. Thank you, Nell. Because they do affect a lot of people, and it do affect their lives. And you said something that touched me, that suicide is generally by people who are committed by people who do have hope, they just don't see it. And I think that rings true in our native nations today.
Absolutely.
As our youth continue to commit suicide from the conditions of assimilation and modernization that's coming in, you know, that came into their life. I mean, you hit that one right on the head. People that do have a hope. I don't know if they have a future, but we do have a hope. And it seems like those are the ones who are taking their lives. And it's time to stop it. We need to stop our children from doing this. And we need to stop. It starts with each and every one of us.
Absolutely. And as adults, it's up to us to reach out to these young people, even when they push us away. But to just sit next to them quietly and say, I'm here. That's it. That's all we need to do. I'm here.
That's some good advice.
Thank you, David.
Russ, I did add a little cushion in. So
go
ahead and do your wrap-up without the worries.
Perfect. Thank you, Nell. Nadine, once again, you have brought more light into people's lives by coming on and speaking your intelligence, something that has been part of your life and something that you have worked on your entire life. And just this morning, I was telling you before the show, and I would like our listeners to know, just this morning, I had a private on Facebook from a woman who was looking for last week's program. She couldn't find it, and she really, really wanted to listen to it because she's trying to reach out and help a friend. And that right there showed me the connection. It showed me that people do want to know, and people do want to help, and people are compassionate, and there is still a hope. And once again, I thank you for continuing coming on the show and bringing your expertise to these subjects that should be talked about in society every day. We need to recognize
this. Thank you so much, Russ. And I think that our expertise is all of us together. It's not one person, as you know, and I know, and all of us know. And I think together, all of us, and I'm reaching out to those people out there that I can't hear your voice, we can make a difference.
We most definitely can. Well, with that, folks, I'd like to thank you all for joining us today, and we will be back next Sunday.
And David.
Once again, thank you all for joining us today. Nadine, you're a pleasure always. Love hearing you. Now, thank you. The issues are amazing. The show is going in the right direction. You have been doing an amazing job with Stage Left. If you guys have not heard what's going on in Stage Left, it is a separate show that Nell produces that puts readers, people with poetry, and musicians up on the stage. You know, there's one thing that I believe is universal in love, and that would be words of encouragement and music. And now you do an amazing job on that. With that, I would like to, you're more than welcome. Thank you. with that, I would like to have David bring us out with one of his beautiful pieces to end another beautiful show. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.